In a statement in Great Controversy, page 588, which reads as follows: through the two great errors, the immortality of the soul and Sunday sacredness, Satan will bring the people under his deceptions. In the last days, the two particular weapons that Satan is going to use are these two. One is the doctrine of the immortality of the soul, and the other is a doctrine of Sunday sacredness. Obviously, then, these are two areas where the people of God must be particularly well-versed and established in present truth. And I believe this, that we must understand far deeper and far better than we do these subjects. It'll not be sufficient, for instance, in regard to the immortality of the soul, to have a long list of proof texts whereby you can show that the dead know nothing, in the grave they are unconscious, and so forth. Neither will it be sufficient in regard to the Sabbath question for us to be able to prove that the seventh day is the true Sabbath of God. After all said and done, the Roman Catholic Church admits that already. Now, I want to take two studies today, one after the other, on these two themes. The first one we will call Preaching the Sabbath More Fully. The next one, a study on the immortality of the soul. In answer to the weapon that Satan uses in regard to Sunday sacredness, we have this statement from Early Writings, page 33, where Sister White made this prophecy. She says, "I saw that God had children who do not see and keep the Sabbath. They have not rejected the light upon it, and at the commencement of the time of trouble, we were filled with the Holy Ghost as we went forth and proclaimed the Sabbath more fully. This enraged the wicked," this enraged the churches and nominal Adventists, "as they could not refute the Sabbath truth. And at this time, God's chosen all saw clearly that we had the truth, and they came out and endured the persecution with us." Let's spend a little time now in looking into the Sabbath question. And I believe that God has begun to reveal to us as his people the beginnings of that greater light on this question, which will enable us to present the truth of it in the living power of it. Let's turn now to begin with to the fifth chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. In this chapter we find that the Ten Commandments are written out almost word for word as you find them in the 20th chapter of the book of Exodus. The fifth chapter of the book of Deuteronomy, if you read from verse 6 down to verse 21, you'll find there are the Ten Commandments in their correct order and practically word for word as they are in Exodus chapter 20. But there is an apparent difference, and particularly in the fourth commandment. Let's begin to read this. The actual fourth commandment begins in verse 12, where it says, "Keep the Sabbath day to sanctify it, as the Lord thy God hath commanded thee. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, nor thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thine ox, nor thine ass, nor any of thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates, that thy manservant and thy maidservant may rest as well as thou." Now, so far, the reproduction is identical with Exodus 20, but now notice this. "And remember that thou wast a servant in the land of Egypt, and that the Lord thy God brought thee out thence through a mighty hand and by a stretched out arm. Therefore, or for this reason, the Lord thy God commanded thee to keep the Sabbath day." Is this the reason given in Exodus chapter 20? No. On the face of it, no, but actually, yes. Now let's look together, shall we? Back in Exodus chapter 20, it says, "For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, wherefore they were told to keep the Sabbath day." But now here, because they have been saved from Egypt, they are told to keep the Sabbath day. So here we find the Sabbath stands as a memorial of both these experiences. Let's turn now to the 20th chapter of the book of Ezekiel and verse 12. Ezekiel 20 and verse 12. A well-known scripture, of course, to every Seventh-day Adventist. Begin back in verse 10. "Wherefore I caused them to go forth out of the land of Egypt and brought them into the wilderness. And I gave them my statutes and showed them my judgments, which if a man do, he shall even live in them. Moreover also I gave them my Sabbaths, to be a sign between me and them, that they might know that I am the Lord that sanctify them." So now we find we come to sanctification. In the Old Testament, of course, and right there we find the Sabbath is placed by God as a symbol of that experience. So here we find where you have the creation of God is the Sabbath of God. The salvation from Egypt, again the Sabbath of God. And sanctification, again we find the Sabbath of God. Now if you were to ask the average Seventh-day Adventist, for instance, what is the keeping of the Sabbath a symbol of? At once they will reply, the creation, which is true, but only so far as it goes. Because we find it's also a symbol of deliverance from Egypt and a symbol of sanctification. Now, if the Sabbath is a symbol of all these three experiences, it follows that all three must have some one thing in common. They have the Sabbath in common. Therefore, what the Sabbath symbolizes, they must have in common. And what they have in common is this. They are all a manifestation of the power of God. By what power was the world first made? By what power were they saved from Egypt? And by what power are we made again? By the power of God. The gospel, which is the power of God. Thank you. Now, as we shall see later in the study, therefore, wherever you see the power of God manifested, there you will find the Sabbath. And where you cannot find the power of God, you will not find the Sabbath either. That has some very, very serious implications, as we shall learn as we proceed. Now, to examine this a little further, let's go back to the original creation now and look at this for just a moment. In the original creation, God gave to man three things. He gave to him, first of all, a perfect character. He gave to man a perfect character. And although it had to be developed, I guess we should use the word nature here. And that was tabernacled in a perfect body. And all of this dwelt in a perfect Eden home. Let's never forget that it required the power of God to do this. In fact, in Psalms 96 and verse 5, we're distinctly told that all the gods of the nations are what? Idols, but the Lord made the heavens. In other words, God alone has creative power. None but He can call into existence matter and life. Now in his home, man lost the perfect character when he sinned, the perfect perfection of body, and he lost the perfect home. He lost all three. But the plan of redemption, as you read in 1 John, it says that Christ came to do what? To destroy the works of the devil. And therefore Christ came to restore to man the character and the body and the home. But does he give back to man all three at the same time? He doesn't. When do we receive back the nature of God? At conversion in this life today. When do we receive back the perfection of body? Second Advent. And the perfect home? right, in the earth made new. Now, if it took the power of God to give to Adam and Eve that perfection of nature in the first case, what would it take to give back to man that same perfection of character in the second case? The same power of God. So therefore, inasmuch as the Sabbath was a symbol of that power giving that character in the first case, what must be the symbol of the giving by that same power of the same character in the second case? The Sabbath once again. There it stands. Now, let's turn a moment now to the experience of deliverance in Egypt. When I was down in South Australia a number of months ago, I guess about a year ago now, we had been studying with a number of very fine Lutheran people, most of whom have since become Sabbath keepers as a result of this particular study. And one of them pointed me to the 5th of Deuteronomy and said, "Now look," he said, "obviously from this scripture, the Sabbath is purely a Jewish institution, because they were in Egypt, they were saved from Egypt, and therefore it's a symbol of their experience." Now he said, "You've never been to Egypt, and I've never been to Egypt, and having never been there, we've never been saved out of it." But is that true? It is not true, because every single one of us has been and may still be in the land of Egypt. Because Egypt is a spiritual land, a land of atheism or unbelief. Let's look a moment at Egypt in the following light. Going back to the Israelite in that land, I'll just draw here a block of stone that the Israelites were preparing for those store cities of Pithom and Ramesses. In the background, we'll draw a pyramid or two to just give the atmosphere to the scene. And bending over this block of stone under the blazing heat of the summer sun was an Israelite with a hammer and a chisel. And he's painstakingly preparing that great block of stone for one of those buildings. Now let's look at this man for a few moments and consider some things about him. Who was he, or what was he? A professed child of whom? God. And as such, he understood the law of God and knew what he should be doing. And yet, don't you see that this man here is spending all of his time, talents, and energy and skill in building up whose kingdom? God's? Satan's kingdom. Building up Satan's kingdom. So this then is what he is doing. Building up Satan's kingdom. Was he thoroughly enjoying himself? Did it give him pleasure? It didn't. In fact, you find in Exodus it says they groaned by reason of their bondage. And the greatest heart longing of those men and women was to escape from this bondage, to get away from it, to be free of it. All right then, if you don't like the job you're doing, what do you do about it? You leave it. But this man didn't leave, he kept right on doing it. Now, why did he go on doing what he did? Because of what he was. Isn't that right? Because of what he was. And what was he? He was a slave. And standing over that man day by day was a taskmaster with a whip in his hands. And that taskmaster said to that man, "You will do what I say that you'll do." And the poor slave had no option but to do what he was told to do. Now you think it through. Isn't this a perfect picture of a professed child of God in the Romans 7 experience? Isn't it? We know what God's law is. We profess to be children of God. We hate the sin that we're doing day by day. And yet, as Paul says, the things I want to do, I can't do. What I hate doing, I do. And so on. Why do we do it? Because, as Paul says, we are carnal, sold under sin. We are in the land of Egypt. Isn't that right? We're in Egypt. And as such, we are powerless to save ourselves. Now you think of all the things that Israel might have appealed to. Let's think of the power of the world which was round about them, the Philistines and the other nations, the Canaanites and so forth. Could the Israelite look to that as a power sufficient to save them from Egypt's power? No, they couldn't. Let's think then of, shall we say, the power of the will. Would that save them? No. What about intellect, genius, talent, cunning, education? None of those things could save those people from the power of Egypt. None of it. What alone could save them? The power of God. And I want you today to see that the land of Egypt was a wonderful representation, or I beg your pardon, the Passover was a wonderful representation of the gospel. The Passover is the unfolding of the gospel in object lesson form. Here we have a door. And as you recall, the father of the home was required to take the blood of the lamb and sprinkle that blood upon the top and the two side posts of the door, and of course the blood would fall down upon the step as well as he brushed it on the top. Just connect those points and you have the symbol of the cross. Here is the inside of the room. Now, every child of Israel ate the Passover supper inside that building, on the sin side of the cross. Isn't that right? On the sin side of the cross. Let me read you a statement here that helps to make this point plain. In the book Desire of Ages again, it says here, speaking of the communion service, and speaking here of those who have gone through the cleansing power of Christ, it says, they are not to stand in the shadow of the cross, which is this side, isn't it, but in its saving light, page 659. In other words, they stood in the shadow of the cross, they looked forward to the experience, and they ate that Passover while they were still in the land of Egypt. The land of bondage, the land of darkness, the land of despair, the land of hopelessness, the land of no progress, the land of death. In other words, every name that you can find to describe their experience in Egypt fitly describes your experience as a slave to sin. Now, before they could leave that land, two things had to happen. The first thing was death. Right? The death of whom? The firstborn of Egypt. Now, the firstborn of Egypt was a symbol of Egypt's power. He was the heir of the nation's wealth and all that. And therefore, the death of the firstborn effectively broke the power of Egypt. And the Lord sent 1, 2, 3, down to 9 plagues. He sent to Pharaoh appeals. He sent to Pharaoh signs and wonders. But did any of those things bring about the release of Israel? None of them. Not any of them on their own, or all of them put together, was sufficient to break Egypt's power and let Israel go. What was it that did break the power of Egypt? Death. Death broke the power of Egypt. And likewise, we can never escape from the land of Egypt as the land of sin, excepting by death. As Mead McGuire so aptly put it, it's not by trying, but it's by dying. Not by trying, but by dying. The old man must die before the new man can live. As it says in Romans chapter 6 and verse, I think about 3. Let's turn to that verse for a moment. Romans chapter 6. It says in verse 5, for if we have been planted together in the likeness of his death, we shall be also in the likeness of his resurrection. Now what's the condition of resurrection or new life? Death. If we die, then and only then can we live. Now when the God of heaven brought about this solution, did he say to the Israelites, now very well, gird on your swords, and at a given hour, rush down to the home of the Egyptians, and my angels will be there to give you strength and power to slay the Egyptians. Kill the Egyptian firstborn with my help. Did God say that? He didn't. He told him to stand still and leave the Lord to do what only God could do. And God slew the firstborn, so in like manner, God destroys out of us the evil root of sin. We can't do it. We can't change our hearts. We can't make ourselves holy. That's a work which God alone can do. Now, the next thing that there had to be life. Before they could leave that room, they must partake of a new life. And so they ate the flesh and the blood of the lamb. So when they had dined, I'm sorry. Yeah, well, I wasn't thinking, they I was thinking of John chapter 6, where it speaks about the body and the blood. They ate the flesh of the lamb, not the blood. That's right. Thanks for the correction. Now, when they had partaken of that life, then they left that room, and every one of them had to go out by the way of the cross. Now, they left behind them bondage. What did they have at once? Freedom. At once. They left behind them hopelessness. What do they now have? Hope. They left behind sorrow and pain. What do they now have? Joy. They left behind sin. What do they now have? Righteousness. They left behind a life of no progress to daily make progress in the Christian walk toward the kingdom of heaven. But they did not that day arrive in Canaan's land, but they began the journey to Canaan. Here is the signboard which says, to Canaan. They began the journey. And that journey was a journey wherein they would be fitted to enter the promised land, wherein daily they learned fresh lessons of faith and obedience. Now, what a perfect picture we have of the new birth experience. We must find the death of the old nature, partake of the new life of Jesus, which is by the way of the cross. And then and only then do we leave behind the land of Egypt. And at once we enter freedom, joy, peace, the leadership of God, and day by day learn lessons of faith and obedience in the school of Christ as a preparation for the coming kingdom. Now then, it was God's plan and God's purpose that ancient Israel should see in this experience that what God had done for them physically, He desired to do for them what? Spiritually. But the tragedy is that the great majority of those people took Egypt right along with them in their hearts. And that explains as to why it is that out there in the wilderness, they continually wish to go back to join again with the land that they had taken with them and thus end the division between Egypt there and Egypt here. After all said and done, don't you desire to be where your heart is? Isn't that true? For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And if you and I together are partakers of Christ's love, if you have His life and I have His life, what do we like to be? Together. But if we don't have that love in our hearts, then naturally we wish to be apart from each other. Yeah, the flesh pots of Egypt, go back to where they eat to the full. So then, what was deliverance from Egypt but simply another reenacting of creation or recreation? Any difference? None at all. So the command to keep the Sabbath in Deuteronomy chapter 5 is no different to Exodus 20 or Ezekiel chapter 20 verse 12. Let's move on a step further now in this story. And the next great event that we're concerned with here is the cross, the death of Christ, and the resurrection of Christ. I'll put them both together for today. The resurrection of Christ. Now, by whose power did Christ come forth from the tomb? The power of God. So if we find that by the power of God, Jesus came forth from the tomb, then the resurrection of Christ and the cross of Christ together are manifestations of God's power. Isn't that right? Manifestations of God's power. And if there we see the power of God, what must we expect to see right then? The Sabbath. Because the Sabbath is God's flag. There must the Sabbath be. Now today, of course, there are many people who are seeking to overthrow the fact that Jesus died on Friday, rested on the Sabbath, and arose on the Sunday. Let's spend just a few moments establishing the great truth that Jesus did indeed die on the Friday afternoon, rested in the grave on the Sabbath, and rose on the Sunday. Now, in the first instance, inasmuch as the death and the resurrection of Christ is the focal point, that is the actual guarantee, the actual bringing of the power of it, it is the work of regeneration or this creation all over again. Now, what difference is there between creation here and what Christ did there upon the cross? Isn't this the work of regeneration? a work of recreation. Therefore, if this is the work of recreation, it must be creation all over again. Now, in the original creation, Christ worked 6 days. And in the 6th day, what did he do? He ended his work. He finished his work on the 6th day. And he rested on the 7th. Therefore, in the inner type, in the doing of this work all over again, must not the same pattern be repeated? Must not? On what day of the week then did Jesus end his work of recreation? By dying on the cross. The 6th day. There is the cross of Calvary on the 6th day. And he rested the 7th day and he arose on the 1st day. Continue his work in both cases. Now there is a statement in the Word of God where it says that as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the whale, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. And entirely misunderstanding the expression in the heart of the earth, people reason that Christ must have spent a full 72 hours in the grave, which would mean that if you had him going into the grave or on Friday afternoon and resting on the Sabbath 24 hours there and arising first thing on Sunday morning, you have nothing like 72 hours altogether. And yet the scripture plainly says, as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the whale, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. Before we examine what this statement means, and it's very, very simply understood in the light of the scriptures, let's take some evidences to show on the other side that Christ did die on the Friday afternoon and he did rise on the Sunday morning. But go back to the type, first of all, in the 23rd chapter of the book of Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 23. And let's follow this through very carefully. Begins by saying in verse 4, these are the feasts of the Lord, even holy convocations, which you shall proclaim in their seasons. In the 14th day of the first month at even is the Lord's Passover. All right? We're plainly told then that on the 14th day of the first month in the even is the Passover. Let me divide the day here into two parts. This is the night and this is the daylight period of the 14th day. There is the 14th day. Now you understand, of course, that in Jewish reckoning, the evening always came before the daylight period. From sundown to sundown was their day. So therefore, if the Passover was in the evening of the 14th day, it would obviously be located here. There is the Passover, the 14th day. That is when they ate the lamb at that time. Verse 6 says, and on the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread unto the Lord. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. So now we have it again. I'll divide this again into, perhaps I'll just make this the daylight period where it's white and the black period the night. Same again here. This now is the 15th day. Now notice something very carefully with me, please. And that is this. Verse 7 says, in the first day, that is, of course, of the 7 days of unleavened bread, in the first day you shall have an holy convocation. You shall do no servile work therein. Now, what does a holy convocation mean? A ceremonial Sabbath. Isn't that right? So this day then was a Sabbath. Now, please distinguish here between a ceremonial Sabbath, which could be on any day of the week, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or Sabbath, and the seventh day Sabbath. Now, if it so happened that the ceremonial Sabbath fell upon the seventh day Sabbath, what was it called? Right, it was called a high day. And the only way in which you could have a high day was for a seventh day Sabbath and a ceremonial Sabbath to fall together. Isn't that right? That's the only way. Good. Now look at verse 10. Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when you be come into the land which I give unto you, and shall reap the harvest thereof, then you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest unto the Lord, unto the priest. And he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord, to be accepted for you, on the morrow after the Sabbath the priest shall wave it. So what day then was the first fruits waved? On the morrow after the Sabbath. So what What date must that have been? 16th. Very good. So this then is the first fruits, the 16th. First fruits. Now in verse 15 we read, "And you shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be complete. Even unto the morrow after the 7th Sabbath shall you number 50 days, and you shall offer a new meat offering unto the Lord." Alright, so 50 days from the 16th, 50 days later, we come to what is known as the Feast of Weeks, or later on, to Pentecost. Now let's notice some things. We know, without even looking it up, that Jesus ate the Passover supper with his disciples in the evening of the Passover day. Right on time. Isn't that right? We know that he was hung upon the cross next morning at the time of the morning sacrifice. The third hour, 9 o'clock in the morning. We know that he died at the time of the evening sacrifice at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So accurately was his death in tune with the actual type. So dead on time that down in the sanctuary, the priest had the knife upraised to slay the lamb. The knife was just about to descend when Christ died upon the cross. The temple veil was rent from top to bottom. The knife dropped from his hands and the lamb escaped. Now how much more accurately could you time a thing than that? Tell me. The reference is found in the Desire of Ages if you want it. Perhaps I should read it to you so you've got that clear and plain. It's page 757, Great Controversy, Desire of Ages. It says on page 756, "When the loud cry, 'It is finished,' came from the lips of Christ, the priests were officiating in the temple. It was the hour of the evening sacrifice. The lamb representing Christ had been brought to be slain. Clothed in his significant and beautiful dress, the priest stood with lifted knife, as did Abraham when he was about to slay his son. With intense interest, the people were looking on. But the earth trembles and quakes, for the Lord himself draws near. With a rending noise, the inner veil of the temple is torn from top to bottom by an unseen hand, throwing open to the gaze of the multitude a place once filled with the presence of God. In this place, the Shekinah had dwelt." Next paragraph. "All is terror and confusion. The priest is about to slay the victim, but the knife drops from his nerveless hand and the lamb escapes. Type has met antitype in the death of God's Son. The great sacrifice has been made." Now Christ ate the Passover on time with his disciples. I beg your pardon, this is the evening here. My mistake. That's the morning part there. He ate the Passover on time with his disciples in the evening. No, I got it wrong now, I'm sorry. I'm getting confused with this chalk. I was right before. That's right there. That's the night. He ate it there. And he was hung upon the cross exactly at the time of the morning sacrifice, and he died exactly at the time of the evening sacrifice, thus fulfilling the daily sacrifice, which was the key to them all, on the Passover day. Now, he was the first fruits of them that slept. Let me pass this over for the moment, shall I? Let's go across to Pentecost. When did the outpouring of the Spirit come? The Word of God says when the day of Pentecost had fully come, what then? Then came the outpouring of the Spirit that experience symbolized. So notice how everything was happening on time. Now if Christ was the first fruits of them who slept, when must he have arisen? On the day of the first fruits. And that was the 16th day of the first month. We know it was very, very early in the morning. That is down here. Very early in the morning, just as the darkest hour was drawing near before the daylight actually came. And if we count up the time from when Jesus was actually placed in the grave on Friday afternoon down until Sunday morning, was that a length of 3 days and 3 nights? It wasn't. Not by any means. But the type teaches us that despite that statement, Christ was crucified on Friday, on the afternoon of the 15th, and he arose in the early morning hours of the 16th, He must do to fulfill the things as far as time was concerned. Let's turn to John the 19th chapter now and notice something here. Now many people say, of course, that when it says the preparation day, it means the preparation for the ceremonial Sabbath. But look at verse 31 of chapter 19. The Jews therefore, because it was the preparation that the bodies should not remain upon the cross on the Sabbath day, for that Sabbath day was what? An high day. Besought Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. So what was this Sabbath? It was a high day. Therefore, it must have been a seventh day Sabbath. Right? Therefore, the day before it, upon which Christ was crucified, must have been Friday. And we distinctly know that Christ had risen on the first day of the week. It says so. Now here is the question then. What does the expression 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth mean? 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. Alright? Last night we looked at Psalms chapter 40. Let's go back there for a moment. In Psalms chapter 40 we found that Christ went down into an horrible pit. Now when you're down in a pit, where are you? In the heart of the earth. Isn't that right? You're in the heart of the earth. Now nobody that I've ever met interprets Psalms 40 verse 2 to mean a literal pit such as Jeremiah went down into. Everybody understands this to mean what? The spiritual pit of sin. That is the heart of the earth. Now did Jesus go down into such a pit? We saw it last night in Desire of Ages. When did he go down into such a pit? On Thursday night, didn't he? Right? He went down into that pit on Thursday night and he arose from that pit on Sunday morning. Now let's count it up, shall we? 3 days and three nights. Thursday night, one night. Friday night, two nights. Saturday night, three nights. So there's the three nights. Now 3 days. Now bear in mind, of course, that Jewish reckoning always provided that there was a part of the day that was counted for the full day. That was their reckoning. Here they are, Friday, Sabbath, and he rose in the very first part of the day on Sunday, which gives you the third day. On Thursday night he went down to the pit, the heart of the earth, and he remained there until his resurrection, which was in fact 3 days and three nights. And so the effort on the part of some, even though they be Seventh-day observers, to do away with the Friday, Sabbath, Sunday crucifixion, rest and raising up of Christ does not stand the test of scriptures. Let's turn now to Hebrews the 4th chapter. And in the New Testament, note the connection that Paul here has between the Sabbath and the creation and the work of the gospel. In verse 1 he gives the warning, "Let us therefore fear lest a promise being left us of entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. For unto us was the gospel preached as well as unto them, but the word preached did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in them that heard it." And notice he says here, that in regard to the rest of sanctification in the New Testament, that's what I just put it over here, I'll just use the word rest here, which is the rest of victory or sanctification. He says, "For unto us was the gospel preached, the power of God, as well as unto them." And no sooner does he speak about the power of God, and his mind goes back to the creation. And then in verse 9 you read, "There remaineth therefore a rest, or the keeping of a Sabbath to the people of God. For he that has entered into his rest, he also has ceased from his own works, as God did from his." And so in the New Testament, the Sabbath still stands there, as it does in the Old, as a symbol of that power, bring rest to the Christian. Now, the next great restoration to man is his body. And this comes at the second advent, or the translation of the righteous living and the resurrection and taking to heaven of the righteous dead. This will be again a manifestation of God's power. So what will be the eternal symbol of that power manifest in that experience? The Sabbath, once again. Now, I have no text at the moment which supports this, but no doubt it'll come to light in due time. Now, the final gift back to man is a new home. By what power will that new home be restored to mankind? By the power of God. Now, if the Sabbath is a symbol of God's power in the original creation, in salvation from Egypt, in sanctification, in the resurrection of Jesus, in the rest of the New Testament, in the translation from this world, what must be the symbol of that same power in the new earth? The Sabbath again. Let's turn to Isaiah 66 and read it here, shall we? This text, of course, is one which we all know quite well. We're very familiar with it. Let's see now what it has to say. Verse 22 and 23. For as the new heavens and the new earth which I will make shall remain before me, saith the Lord, so shall your seed and your name remain. So there's the wonderful promise to the restoration of the new earth. And right there in the next verse is the Sabbath. And it shall come to pass that from one new moon to another, and from one Sabbath to another, shall all flesh come to worship before me, saith the Lord. There it is again. So trace through the whole Bible from cover to cover, and wherever you find God's power manifest, there you find the Sabbath, all the way through. Now what does this mean? It means this, that where the power of God is, there is the Sabbath. But where the power of God is not, then what? There's no Sabbath. Now you may be observing the seventh day of the week, but if you are destitute of the living power of a living God in your life, the presence of which power is revealed by your experiencing a living victory over sin, unless you have that within you, then you most certainly do not have the Sabbath. You are not a Sabbath keeper. Isn't that right? You are not a Sabbath keeper. Now, what are we then? The devil also has a flag. And his flag is Sunday. The Roman Church openly boasts of the fact that the establishment of that day in contradistinction to God's day is the proof of the power of this church. You've read such statements. It is, of course, at the very opposite end of the week, the beginning of the week. Now, wherever Satan's power is, then what flag waves wherever Satan's power is? The Sunday flag. So that means this, that you can actually be observing the seventh day of the week, but if observing it without the power of God in your life, you must observe it with whose power in your life? Satan's power. And if you have his power in your life, wherever that power is, what stands? Sunday. Which means a person can be observing the seventh day of the week and yet be in actual fact a Sunday keeper. Pardon? Sure. Have the spirit of Sunday be a Sunday keeper. Now, in the last days, the great battle that's going to be waged is not simply going to be a battle as to whether Sunday or Saturday is the right day of the week. It's going to be a contest between the power of God and the power of sin. Isn't that right? It will be the last great head-on conflict of these two great powers, the power of God versus the power of Satan. Where the power of God is, they will wave the Sabbath flag. And all those who have the power of God will stand under that flag, the Sabbath. But where the power of sin is, there will wave the Sunday flag. And all those who belong on that side will stand underneath that flag. And there will be the two great armies. For us to stand under this flag, we must ourselves have the living power of a living God. Now let's pause a moment and consider this. Let's see what the Protestant or Sunday churches are doing when they claim that Sunday is a symbol of the resurrection. Now, they have taken the Sabbath away from there and they put a different flag up. They have put up the Sunday flag. Now, let's see what they're doing. During the Second World War, Japanese and the Americans fought for the Pacific. (Clears throat) The Americans have recently occupied the Philippines. While they occupied the Philippines, their power was the power which controlled that country. Throughout that country was their power. And while their power was there, the American flag, the stars and stripes, waved throughout that country. When the Japanese came in, and throughout the American power, what was the first thing they did? They pulled down the flag. Therefore, their pulling down of that flag was their acknowledgement or statement that they had ousted or gotten rid of the power of America from that place. The Sabbath waves over the resurrection of Jesus Christ as a symbol that there is the power of God. Now, when the churches of this world invade the great truth of the resurrection and tear down the Sabbath flag and put Satan's flag up the Sunday, are they not thereby showing that they have gotten rid of God's power out of their lives, want nothing to do with God's power, and have put in its place the great symbol of Satan's power? Thus they show themselves in this very fact to be absolutely antichrist. And in the great day when we go forth to proclaim the Sabbath more fully and show the churches of this world who profess to be serving God what they are actually doing, this will indeed enrage the churches, because they will not be able to refute the truth of it. It will be too plain and too clear to refute it, because this is the picture they will have. The Sabbath is a symbol of creation. They can't deny that in the Old Testament, or of Egypt, or of sanctification in the Old Testament. But here where they live, they've taken away the Sabbath and put Satan's power there in its place, and thus show themselves to be, in every sense of the word, antichrist. Let me conclude now by taking this statement from the Desire of Ages in regard to the Sabbath, where Sister White has this to say. Page 283. No other institution which was committed to the Jews tended so fully to distinguish them from surrounding nations as did the Sabbath. God designed that its observance should designate them as his worshippers. It was to be a token of their separation from idolatry and their connection with the true God. But in order to keep the Sabbath holy, men must themselves be holy. Through faith they must become partakers of the righteousness of Christ. When the command was given to Israel, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, the Lord said also to them, you shall be holy men unto me. Only thus could the Sabbath distinguish Israel as the worshippers of God. Note that. Only by themselves being holy could the Sabbath distinguish Israel as the worshippers of God. So let us, as we face the great final conflict, make certain that we do have the gospel, the living power of a living God to save from sin. Then we will be Sabbath keepers and able to go forth and win the battles of the Lord and find ourselves at last with a new body and a new home, Sabbath keepers for eternity.